Chapter 11. An Aggressive Act of Personal Reinvention. Shane Hall was running for his life. The diner disaster had scrambled his brain. His heart was shredded. His stomach was in knots. In a former life, he would have dealt with this in dangerous ways. But due to his recent aggressive act of personal reinvention, he was no longer a drinker. He was a runner. A capital R runner. And you knew he was serious because he bought Nike Vaporflies, the sneakers the Olympics almost banned for giving runners an advantage. And he was also wearing the Garmin Forerunner 945 GPS watch to monitor his pace in pro-marathoner style. Most notable, though, were his elite-grade compression socks, which were recommended by Usain Bolt and an old Esquire he'd dog-eared in some Midwestern JetBlue VIP lounge. His gear was fire. Shane didn't half-ass anything. He ran as hard as he drank. Never mind that in AA he was warned of the dangers of cross-addiction, when you put down a drink and pick up a new obsession, like evangelism or multi-level marketing schemes or rescuing pit bulls. And fine, Shane knew that his running habit bordered on extreme, but what new addictions could possibly scare him? Not having a drink was excruciating, and he beat that. Not having anything else would be easy. So Shane ran and ran, until the steady, hypnotic rhythm of his footfalls and his modulated, focused breathing coaxed him into calm, because he'd had a day. The sun was just about to set beyond the upper Manhattan skyline, and Shane was trying to outrun it. He'd already run the 6 miles from his rental in the West Village, down the West Side Highway and around South Street Seaport. Now he was looping his way back up. At first, his pace was too aggressive, too swift. But for the past 10 minutes or so, he started slowing a bit. He was right on the cusp of exhaustion, but that was what kept Shane going. That flicker of uncertainty, the threat of burning out. And he had to keep going, because he wanted to be home before nightfall. He couldn't be away from the apartment for longer than an hour. He told Eva to come by if she needed him, and ever since she'd fled, crying, from the diner that morning, he'd been waiting for her. He probably wouldn't hear from her, but on the off chance that she wanted to talk, he had to be there. He'd been the one to make her cry. It was what he always did. Destroying the people he loved the most, the things that made him happiest. Seeing her that upset again, knowing he was the cause of it, it had triggered an old panic that was too deep-seated to shake. He had to fix it. He couldn't let that be the last time they saw each other. Chin down, eyes trained ahead of him, he blazed his way down the West Side Highway running path, the glittering Hudson River winding lazily to his left, with the New Jersey skyline stretching beyond it. It was thickly hot, the kind of heat that makes you listless and lethargic. Visibly drained tourists draped themselves over benches while the path was crowded with barely moving senior joggers and mommy groups ambling by with designer strollers. Everyone but Shane was on chill mode. Was it selfish to hope for even a second more of Eva's time when he was the reason she wasn't okay? Probably. Was it reckless and childish to have sent her all those texts? Fuck yes. But he'd analyzed the situation too many times since this morning, and he didn't know what else to do. I shouldn't have come at all, thought Shane, almost colliding with a 20-something couple who were somehow successfully jogging while sharing ear pods. But he had come. He'd started another fire. This time he'd stay and put it out. Slowing his pace, Shane glanced up at the horizon to check the sunset. The pre-dusk sky was vivid with waves of fuchsia and lavender, and not for the first time since getting clean, he was struck by how alive the world looked. He was suddenly so alert. It was how he'd been as a little kid, before he'd started anesthetizing himself. Back then, he'd felt things too deeply for his own good. One time, while waiting in a Kmart checkout line, 5-year-old Shane had seen some guy steal a waffle iron from a woman's cart while she wasn't looking. His mind had quietly spiraled over it. What if waffles were all she had to feed her 13 badass kids because their dad squandered her modest bank teller salary on fantasy football bets and scratch cards? What if her life depended on that waffle iron? He'd obsessed about it for days. And snakes used to ruin him. Just the idea of them. Shane couldn't bear the thought of those delicate-looking reptiles trying their hardest to travel around their patch of forest while legless and footless. It broke his heart. They were so unfairly handicapped. He used to obsessively sketch pictures of snakes with 4 legs until it occurred to him that he was, in fact, drawing lizards. The world was too loud for little boy Shane. What he didn't know was that he was training himself to be a deeply empathetic writer, understanding nuanced emotion, spying humanity in unexpected places, seeing past the obvious. He was taking notes for his future self, who would write it all down. Every fucking thing he saw. And thank God he was good at it. If nothing else, writing helped organize the chaos in his brain, even if it had only come in 4 intense bursts over the past 15 years. I'm already thinking of my career in past tense, he realized, speeding up a bit. Shane wrote his books hoping to smooth out the jagged edges of his life, which didn't exactly work. If reviewers were to be believed, his novels could rearrange the way a reader thought, sparking existential epiphanies. But he could never reach himself. In fact, his biggest triumphs were followed by his biggest benders. No matter how dizzying his professional highs, Shane just couldn't resist the pull of the tide sweeping him out. Self-destruction was always imminent. No. If writing had been the cure, the past 15 years would have looked very different. He wouldn't have taken so long to get sober. He might have picked a permanent place to live, put down actual roots, invested in Seamless or Spotify. He'd have gotten serious about the business of living. And he would have found Eva long ago. Stretching ahead of Shane was Pier 25. Families swarmed the turf overlooking the water, taking pics or waiting to hop in rented kayaks. Shane glanced over at the dads with toddlers on their shoulders while moms juggled cell phones, snacks, stuffed animals, and juice boxes in 2 hands. It was all so exotic. He'd always appreciated families from a distance, looked at them like they were a fascinating experiment. All that intimacy and domesticity couldn't have been more foreign. Maybe it was the disjointed way Shane grew up, but he didn't know how to cultivate that sense of home. So he rejected it. He always lived alone, far from crowds and populated cities, especially ones that reminded him of D.C., preferably near the ocean and rarely longer than 6 months. Rentals only. There was a freedom in staying at places that weren't his. Shane reveled in that vaguely disorienting vibe of bed and breakfasts, Airbnbs, somebody's seaside shack, just passing through places where things were a little bit off. Lamps instead of overhead lighting, sheets aggressively scented with some foreign fabric softener, jumpy ceiling fans and dusty bookshelves with eclectic 80s paperbacks, often historical westerns featuring covers with chesty women and sometimes a horse. It was impossible to get too comfortable in a place that kept reminding you it wasn't yours. And it was impossible for anyone to know him, either. Which was perfect. During his lost years, he hadn't wanted people to see how unstable he was. Of course, sobriety had shown him that everyone was a little bit off. His shit was just closer to the surface. What's wrong with you? Eva had asked that first day. Shane had been fielding this question for years, but when Eva said it, it was the first time he'd actually given it any real thought. She'd asked with curiosity, not judgment. Shane was a complete stranger and confessed to breaking his arm on purpose, but she didn't write him off or condemn him, or worse, laugh. She didn't try to convince him to stop. Eva's generosity was stunning. She just wanted to know why. And he would have told her. But back then, he couldn't articulate the reasons why he did that to himself. Keeping a steady pace, Shane powered past City Vineyard, the riverfront restaurant with its dazzling downtown skyline views and digital nomads sipping rosé in plastic glasses. The sweet fermented scent of a bar wafted over him on the dry, hot breeze, driving him to run faster. With every heavy footfall, every forward swing of his upper body, the bones in his left forearm reverberated, a low thrum just enough so he could never forget his old habit. And what exactly was wrong with him? The first time it happened was when Shane was 7. The terrible event that had sent him hurtling from foster home to foster home, where he learned new crimes, new dysfunctions, new ways to be unloved. That was one piece of it. The other was every time he broke his arm, it hurt. But when it dulled, he'd be shot through with this remarkable insight about himself. It was the only time he saw who he was crystal clear. The second time, he was a third grader in a DC juvenile detention center, and a guard was mercilessly kicking his ass for sleeping through lunch. Shane kept fighting back, a mad-as-hell Mighty Mouse with rapid-fire fists. Finally, the guard knocked him off his feet with a quick, decimating blow to the jaw, and Shane purposely used his arm to break his fall, bone broken. Oh, he realized, I'm a person who doesn't know when to stop. Another time, he was a 12-year-old in the schoolyard. In a school full of rowdy, troubled misfits, Shane already had a reputation for being the craziest. In front of a crowd, some girl dared an older kid to crack him over the head with a Snapple bottle, just to see what Shane would do. In a flash, Shane had the older dude in a headlock and then flung them both against a brick wall, elbow first, bone broken. Oh, he realized, I'm a person people watch for entertainment. Later at 17, a loud-mouthed knucklehead was bullying the new kid, and to save her, Shane whacked him in the face with his casted arm, bone broken. Oh, he realized, I'm a person who'll do anything for this girl. Before Eva had so dramatically collided with him on the bleachers, Shane had felt like he was slipping away. And there was certainly no school counselor, no parent, no concerned social worker grounding him to the earth. Then he met Eva, and she breathed the same air. She stuck to his bones, imprinted herself on his brain, and thoroughly rearranged his world in the best way. Stop thinking about the past. Start thinking about how you're going to explain yourself to this woman. Shane was mired in these thoughts when his phone vibrated on his arm, where it was slotted in his Nathan iPhone armband rated best accessory of 2019 by runnersworld.com. He froze abruptly on the path. A few paces behind Shane, a group of baroquely mustachioed and muscle-bound Bushwick dudes skidded to a halt seconds before they would have body-slammed into him. The fuck, bro? The near collision didn't register, because Shane was too busy praying. This was it. The moment. Eva finally wanted to talk. He issued a silent plea to the universe that he was right and snatched the phone out of his armband. It was Marisol, Detuan, Reginald, and Ty. Four of his favorite students had texted him, one after the other. Wiping sweat from his forehead and drooping with disappointment, Shane zigzagged through the joggers to a small stretch of Emerald City green grass to the left of the path. Finding an empty spot, he collapsed on his back, exhausted and winded. So Eva still wasn't speaking to him. But hearing from his kids was second best. Like he did with Ty, Shane promised all the students he mentored that he'd always be available. These were at-risk kids. None of them had real parental figures, and he'd happily stepped into the position. Shane strongly doubted he'd have his own children. He didn't trust his DNA. And the question of who his birth parents were, well, he had a feeling it was better not knowing. But for a misanthropic nomad with no professional training in mentoring teenagers, and whose own teenage years could have inspired a chilling docuseries on Vice TV, he owned the role. It fit him almost too comfortably. Shane's life as a teacher hit harder and was more rewarding than making it onto a bestsellers list. He was probably too attached to surrogate parenting other people's kids. There had been a few moments, like when Bree, his favorite student in Houston, was strong-armed by a cop after a neighbor called the police on her loud but innocent Sweet 16 party, when his investment spilled over into something unhealthy. His reaction was thunderous, and it was the first and only time he felt unsteady in sobriety. But he loved those kids. They needed him. And Shane never actually slipped, so it was worth the risk. Today, 7:57 p.m., Marisol.
Mr. Hall, is cat food poisonous when people eat it? Mistakes were made.
Today, 7:59 p.m., Daytuan.
What's good? Funny shit. Principal Parker thought WTF meant, well, that's fantastic.
Today, 8:02 p.m., Reginald.
Sup, broke up with Taja. She's a bad GF, told her actions speak louder than wombats. Womes. Words, fucking autocorrect.
Today, 8:06 p.m., Ty.
WYD, I like the planetarium.
Shane's brows crinkled in surprise. Ty didn't like anything. And if he did, he certainly never articulated it. He barely articulated anything at all. Shane's entire goal in setting up the internship at the planetarium was to get him invested in something, show him what it was like to pursue a passion. Shane glanced up at the sky. He wanted to be home before night fell in case Eva stopped by. He had time for a call.
Ty, what's good, dog? I got your text.
Yeah.
You like the planetarium internship?
It's aight. Tell me about it.
Why do you like it?
Silence.
Ty?
I'm shrugging.
Shane sighed. He really needed to work with Ty on his communication skills.
You just said, I like the planetarium. That's a powerful declarative statement. When you express an opinion, you should be prepared to support it with viable evidence. You enjoy it based on what?
I don't know. It's just chill. Like, I don't know why.
Ty paused for a moment.
I mean, in the Sky Theater.
Sky Theater?
That's what Mr. James calls it. In the Sky Theater, it's like I'm a real astronomer. Like, for real, for real. I can see the sun's path from east to west, look up close at the moon.
That's incredible, Ty. I know the moon's your shit.
Yeah, and today we learned about bizarre stellar objects like neutron stars, pulsars, black holes, and there's a girl.
Shane smiled.
Oh, word?
Yeah, she'd be in there sometime, she draws or whatever. Today she drew a white dwarf.
Shane stared blankly into the sky.
But why?
A white dwarf's a star that's exhausted its nuclear fuel.
Oh.
What's her name? You talk to her?
Nah, I can't talk to her.
She bad, huh?
More silence.
Ty, are you shrugging?
Yeah.
Listen, you're smart, you're loyal. You're one of the most interesting kids I've ever met. You never know, this girl might go to the planetarium every day, hoping that you'll speak to her. Just try.
Can I ask you something?
As usual, Ty's questions sounded like statements.
How you know when you really feelin' a girl?
Shane sat up a bit, leaning back on his elbows. Liking the planetarium girl was monumental for a deeply insecure kid like Ty, and must be dealt with gently. "When it's real," declared Shane, "you won't even have to ask the question. It just hits you, kind of like being shot."
"Shot?"
repeated Ty, sounding doubtful. "So much for gently," thought Shane.
"Hear me out," said Shane. "It's like you know something dramatic happened, but you don't know your insides have been ripped open until after the fact. That's what falling in love is like. When it's real, you don't fall in love with any awareness. You don't get a say. You get hit fucking hard and then process it later. You know?"
More silence.
"I ain't trying to get shot, fam."
"Ty, it was a metaphor."
"Yeah, but like, I just want to ask if she wants to go with me to Cold Stone or whatever, get some ice cream," grumbled Ty. "You're doing too much."
"See?
You don't even need my help. You got a plan," said Shane encouragingly. "Just ask her out tomorrow, and be confident with it. If you believe you're that dude, she will too." "Maybe I should ask her if she's lactose intolerant first."
"Under no circumstances should you do that."
"Nah, you right."
"Listen, you got this," said Shane.
"Hit me back. Let me know how it goes." "I'll get at you. Good looking out," said Ty, and then he clicked off.
Shane slipped his phone back in his armband, buzzing with hope for that kid. Ty would be fine. The sun had just set, and there was still a chance, an off chance, a slim to none chance, that Eva would come. He set off jogging through the bendy West Village streets back to Horatio Street. There was a strong possibility that the diner was the last time he'd ever see Eva. But he couldn't help wanting more. Seeing her again was stressful and world-tilting. But underneath, it was good. Too good. On the flight to New York, Shane had imagined a million scenarios of how their meetup would go. He'd hoped he wouldn't feel anything. But like he'd just told Ty, he didn't really have a say in it, did he? Chapter 12. 20 Questions. 2004. It was after dark when Shane brought Genevieve to an immense, uninhabited mansion on Wisconsin Avenue. As always, he felt nothing but derision for people who'd own a place like this and never even bother to live there. If it were his, he'd have to be forcibly removed. The decor looked like a museum. There were gold filigree accents and animal skin rugs everywhere. Twinkling chandeliers. A dizzyingly abstract, primary color, splashed painting hung over a horsehair couch in the foyer. That couch was a prickly horror never meant to be sat on. Genevieve plonked herself down on it immediately. She didn't ask how Shane knew the alarm passcode, or why, despite the house being bathed in darkness, he knew his way around. Tomorrow, he'd explain that it was his friend's childhood home. She lived on campus at Georgetown Law. Her dad was the Korean ambassador, and since her parents more or less lived in Seoul, the house was usually empty. She'd extended an open invitation for Shane to stay whenever he wanted to escape. He hoped Genevieve wouldn't ask what he did in return for her generosity. Not that he was ashamed. He just didn't want her to know how desperate he was. But then Shane remembered her expression in the ER when he asked her to run away. The look on her face had been wild, a flash of despair mixed with thrill. An automatic yes, because the alternative was unthinkable. This was a girl who understood desperation. Shane led her through the Mexican-tiled kitchen to a servant stairwell and up to a suite on the third floor. Once a fancy teenage girl's bedroom, today it doubled as attic storage. Photo albums, dolls, ancient magazines, snow globes, and flutes were stacked in neat piles. There were two massive French doors leading out to a terrace overlooking a rolling green backyard with a kidney-shaped pool. Holding Genevieve's hand,
Shane led her slowly to a canopied four-poster bed, plush with pale pink bedding. Then he reached under the bed and pulled out a tray with gallon-sized baggies holding endless amounts of weed, pills, syringes, powders. They were labeled by feeling. Coma, Valium. Chill, weed. Party, cocaine. Elsats, Adderall. Whore, ecstasy. Numb, Percocet. And so on. The Georgetown girl was a whimsical drug addict, and he was her dealer. Shane peeled off his tea and collapsed on top of the covers next to Genevieve. They smoked a roach till it was gone. At some point, they curled into each other. Genevieve's face nestled into Shane's neck, his fingers tangling themselves in her curls. It was a hazy, blissful thing, holding her so close in this innocent way. He slept harder than he had in his life. Around 10 p.m., Annabelle Park strode into her parents' home. She was wearing a baby pink, juicy couture mini dress and diamond studs. Nestled inside her Louis Vuitton dog carrier was her chihuahua, Nicole Ritchie. Annabelle knew Shane was there. He'd called. Of course, he and his beautiful dick were always welcome. Plus, he was fabulous company, because he never spoke. She'd gossip to him about DC elites, and he'd lie there, looking deceptively attentive. Grinning, she trotted up both flights of stairs. Annabelle flung open her old bedroom door. Instantly, she was assaulted by the decadent scent of expensive weed and the sight of Shane in her bed, all cuddled up with some chick. That messy motherfucker. Her first instinct was to kick him out, but, well, she wasn't a monster. Where would he go? In 10 months, she'd learned only 3 things about Shane. The first was that he lived in some Miss Hannigan-ass children's shelter. The internet said it was an asylum where minors were sent after failing more than 20 trial runs with foster families. The good kids took brain-dulling antipsychotic meds with no argument, while bad ones were put in solitary, tied to radiators, twisted Victorian shit. She couldn't send him back there. By the way, yes, Annabelle was feeling mildly jealous, but it would pass. After all, she was in the middle of planning a $125,000 fall wedding to Dr. Jonathan Kim at the Four Seasons in Georgetown. Whenever it was vacant, Annabelle's parents' house was a crash pad for her assorted strung-out friends and their strung-out friends. There were few things she respected less than her parents' house. Shane and the waif with the tragic hair could stay. The staff would be back next Monday to clean up anyway. Annabelle crept in to get a closer look. Shane and the girl sported matching black eyes. She was clasping Shane's arm as if she were adrift in a biblical-level sea storm, and he were her only anchor. Annabelle felt sad for her. Shane couldn't be anyone's anchor. He'd never love anything more than getting obliterated. The second thing she knew about Shane was that despite being chased by some powerful demons, he always survived unscathed. But Annabelle suspected that the girl who fell for him wouldn't have the same luck. When it was over, she'd stagger away, scarred for life. Annabelle tiptoed downstairs to the servant's kitchen. She grabbed 2 bags of frozen peas and a chilled bottle of Paluga vodka. Back upstairs, she carefully laid the frozen bags on their faces for the bruises. Then she placed the vodka on the nightstand. Shane couldn't wake up without it. That was the third thing she knew about him. With a smug hair flip, she picked up Nicole Ritchie, spun on her shoes, and left. Annabelle's haters thought she was a mean coke whore with fake cheekbones, and yes, she did have fake cheekbones. But she also had a very real heart. Annabelle Park, soon to be Annabelle Kim, was 22 and was grateful to be an adult. Grown women knew better than to attach themselves to time bombs. Teenage girls couldn't wait to be ruined. When Shane woke up, he didn't know what time it was, what day it was, or where he was. All he knew was that he awoke gently, floating, peaceful.
And as he did, Shane gradually came to the awareness that he was caressing the preternaturally soft, sweet skin of a girl, and that he was big-spooning this girl, and it was Genevieve. And then he remembered everything, school, the hospital, the frantic dash to the house, and then smoking and smoking before drifting off together. Hazy flashes from the night came rushing back. He remembered jolting awake from a dream, realizing she was too far away, and pulling her against him, with an unthinking neediness he'd never allowed himself to feel before. At one point, during a brief glimmer of consciousness, he'd realized they were clinging to each other ferociously, smothering each other so that it was almost too hard to breathe, but it felt so good that before drifting off again, he thought, fuck it, dying like this would be worth it. Shane opened his eyes. Genevieve's head was lying on his good arm, which was 100% numb, and his casted one was resting on her hip. He took in the spacious, girly room with the canopy over the king-sized bed, shading them from the sun streaming through the glass terrace doors. The clock on the wall read 2 p.m. They'd slept for 13 hours. Groaning a little, he felt his usual morning tremors. The uncontrollable shaking that alerted him he'd need a drink. Soon. But not right now. Right now, he needed to bury his entire face in the coconut-scented warmth of Genevieve's hair. The way she had become so important to him in just a day was inexplicable. But inexplicable things happened to him, and Shane accepted life's oddities. He didn't know if this made him an adventurer or an idiot, but one thing was true. Nothing interesting ever came from a clear path of rationality. On the bleachers, all he'd wanted to do was enjoy his vodka and ketamine buzz while reading a book he'd already read 14 times. It was comforting to Shane, knowing what words were coming next. And that was what was inexplicable about Genevieve. It felt like she was supposed to come next. Like the chapter had already been written and they were just taking their places. Like he already knew her by heart. Shane inhaled her scent again, savoring her. Nothing's better than this, he thought sleepily. That was when he noticed the vodka on the nightstand. Suddenly, wide awake, Shane gazed from the bottle to Genevieve's perfect almond-brown shoulder and then back to the bottle. With clarity, he decided that the two most urgent things in the universe were A, keeping her in his arms, and B, procuring the vodka. How he would get from here to there without waking her up was a question of logistics. Carefully, his good arm still trapped under Genevieve, he reached over her with his casted arm, fingers still inches from the bottle. He scooted her forward a bit and, with Herculean effort, lunged across her and grabbed at it. Shane twisted off the cap with his teeth and downed three huge gulps. As he took a breath and another swig, the shaking slowed, and he started to feel normal. Shane reached over Genevieve and placed it back on the nightstand. He stared at the ceiling. Then he rolled her over and reached for it again. "How many times are we gonna do this?" asked Genevieve, her voice muffled by the pillow. "Whoa," he exclaimed. "You're awake?"
"I am now."
She grabbed the bottle and handed it to him, turning so they were face to face. God, she looked adorable in his t-shirt, with her wild hair and sleep-creased cheeks. "Hi," he said, with a face-splitting smile. Genevieve smiled back, but then her expression grew dark. "What's wrong?"
"No, I'm confused," she stammered, looking lost. "What happened? Where am I? And who are you?"
Shane's eyes widened. Had Genevieve's head hit the floor after she got punched? Did she have concussion-related memory loss?
"No, no."
He wouldn't panic. "What's the last thing you remember?" he asked. Genevieve squeezed her eyes shut.
"Cincinnati."
"Cincinnati?"
"It's in Ohio," she said.
"You serious?" Shane sat up, propping himself against the velvet headboard. He dropped his head into his hands. "No, no, no, no." Genevieve's mouth trembled and then her eyes crinkled, and she burst out laughing.
You're so shook.
Fuck me, he breathed. Despite himself, his mouth curved into a grin, and then he chuckled shakily. I really thought you had amnesia.
Looking proud, Genevieve sat up next to him, shoulder to shoulder. Convincing, right? I grew up watching Days of Our Lives.
You're a very strange person, he said worshipfully. Nodding in agreement, she leaned her head on his shoulder. No, but for real. You remember how we got here, right? You're not scared?
Nothing scares me, said Genevieve with confidence.
Shane didn't quite believe her, though, because just then the phone in her backpack buzzed, and she tensed against him. It buzzed and buzzed, but she made no move to answer it. He wondered who was calling her. Slipping his arm around her shoulders, he pulled her closer, wanting to obliterate her worry, or at least cuddle it out of her. Genevieve let out a small, contented sigh that ended in a slight moan, and it took all he had not to kiss her. Shane couldn't. He couldn't make it about that. With everything that had happened in the past 24 hours, kissing should have been nothing. But with Genevieve, it'd be something. With her, it'd be a promise.
I don't even know you, murmured Genevieve, tracing an old scar on his chest with her index finger. Why don't we feel like strangers?
Don't ask, said Shane. You pull a loose thread and the whole shit unravels. Her phone buzzed again. This time she looked over at her backpack, which was flung across a wicker chair. Her face was cloudy with worry and dread, but she continued to ignore it. She bit her bottom lip.
Hey, wanna go somewhere and be bad?
Youthful indiscretion bad or arrested bad?
I can't get arrested. My face is all bruised up. How would my mugshot look?
Authentic? Stretching a little, his leg hit something cold. Shane dug underneath the sheets and unearthed a bag of defrosted peas. We slept with peas? These yours?
No. Everyone hates peas.
Huh. Shane took an indulgent swig from the bottle. Something oxidized in his brain and he was starting to feel properly drunk. This is good vodka. He studied the bottle with a quizzical expression. Whose is this?
Do you have amnesia?
Genevieve said, smirking. Yo, he said, my short-term memory is so fucked.
Ketamine is a terrible habit.
Life is a terrible habit, he said, a reckless glint in his eye. Wanna go down to the pool and get fucked up? Before she could answer, Genevieve's phone buzzed again.
Yeah, let's go swimming, she said quickly. But what about your cast?
Saran wrap, he said with a shrug. Will swimming hurt your head, though? I don't want to make it worse. Genevieve rested her chin on his arm. She gazed up at him with a soft expression, a trace of a smile playing on her lips.
No one ever asks, she said quietly. I'll be fine. But how fucked up are we getting? What if we drown?
Shane couldn't respond. He was tangled up in her face. He lost track of the conversation completely, hopelessly captivated by her onyx eyes, her languid energy, the buzzing warmth of her skin against his. What if we drown? He already had. Genevieve's phone buzzed again. This time, she shot Shane an apologetic look and yanked the phone from her backpack. From the bed, Shane saw the name Lizette flash across the screen. She muted the phone and tossed it on the chair, and stood there rubbing her temples with her knuckles. Her mood had changed. She was radiating anxiety.
Does your friend have anything for pain?
She sounded vague and far away.
I don't have my pills.
Shane reached under the bed for Annabelle's stash and crawled out of the bed, handing Genevieve the baggie labeled numb. Yeah, I sold her most of this shit. I'll just restock later.
Thanks.
With downcast eyes, she grabbed a switchblade-sized pouch from her backpack, shifting her weight from one foot to the other. Preoccupied, she started scratching her inner arm, the skin blazing an angry red.
Genevieve, you good? He asked, moving closer.
No.
She raised her hand, stopping him.
I mean, yes, I just need to use the bathroom. Give me a minute.
Nodding, he said, whatever you need to do.
Genevieve walked across the buffed to perfection wood floors to the adjoining bathroom, the interior of which was outfitted in Burberry plaid wallpaper and gold fixtures. She shut the door behind her. He knew what she was doing in there. He wanted to stop her, but it was none of his business. On the one hand, they were currently sharing a space, but on the other, it would be hypocritical of him to dictate which destructive behaviors were and weren't appropriate. Clutching the vodka, Shay knocked on the bathroom door.
Can I just stand here? On the other side of the door?
The silence lasted too long. Shane wondered if he could break down the door if he had to.
Why?
Genevieve's voice sounded weak.
So you're not alone.
Really?
She paused. When she spoke again, her voice was closer.
Yeah, I guess.
Shane leaned his back against the door, scratching his jawline, plucking at his bottom lip, cracking his knuckles.
You want to talk, or...
Just then he felt a Genevieve-sized pressure on the other side of the door.
Okay.
She sounded close enough to touch.
Let's talk.
20 questions, he said, clearing his throat. I'll go first. What kind of French are you? Haitian, Algerian?
Louisiana.
Your dad's from Louisiana?
My dad's unknown.
So's mine.
Ever wonder who yours is?
Nah, I'm good. The concept of father just feels made up, like Santa or the Easter Bunny.
Shane tapped the bottle against his leg.
Never believed in those niggas either.
When I was little, said Genevieve, I wished he was Mufasa.
Shane paused. I'm gonna say something controversial.
Don't tell me you haven't seen The Lion King.
It's just, Victor's right history, right? What if Mufasa was the bad guy, and we don't know because he's the star of the story? Circle of Life feels like propaganda to put working class animals in their place. Like, shut the fuck up, you're meant to be eaten. Maybe I'm bugging.
You're not bugging, you're a psychopath, she said.
But he could hear a smile in her voice.
My turn. Do you know your mom?
Nah. Orphan. You got a mom?
Her silence felt heavy.
Sometimes.
Better than nothing, right?
Debatable, she sighed. My turn. Any hidden talents?
Shane tapped his bottom lip, wondering if he was going to admit this to her.
I can sing. He confessed haltingly. Really sing. On some smooth R&B shit, like no matter the song, it could be Happy Birthday. My voice comes out sounding like Genuine. It's fucking embarrassing.
Genevieve wailed with laughter.
Sing something. A big song like End of the Road, The Thong Song, Beautiful by Aguilera.
He half grinned. You want me to humiliate myself for you?
No, I want you to want to humiliate yourself for me.
They laughed, and soon they were quiet. Shane taking measured sips and Genevieve silent. Shane was seeing double. He closed one eye and his vision rebalanced.
Hey, he started. Why do you do it?
Don't know. I go into a daze.
She sounded far away again.
There's a relief after.
Does it hurt?
That's the point.
Same with my arm, he admitted. Hurts, but I need it. Like it's the glue holding me together.
She said something inaudible and then,
gonna sit now.
Shane felt her weight slide down the door. He sat down too. He didn't know how long they were like that. Time was elastic. After a while, Shane passed out. He must have slept hard because when Genevieve finally opened the door, he fell flat on his back with a dull thunk.
Let's go to the pool,
She sounded strong, cheerful. Shane peered up at her from the floor. Genevieve was wearing a brilliant smile, like the pills had kicked in and what had been hurting her no longer did. She was soaking wet, hair dripping. Had she taken a shower with her clothes on? The only sign that she'd cut herself was the discreet band-aid on her inner forearm. Stupefied, Shane stared at his drenched t-shirt gripping her skin, her bra, her panties, and he was caught between a helpless surge of arousal and uneasy fascination. It's like nothing's happened. She didn't seem hurt. She seemed triumphant. A force of nature. For a heated, drunken moment, Shane thought he'd hallucinated the whole thing. But then confidently she stepped over him, dripping everywhere and striding out of the room. "Get up," she called out over her shoulder. Without thought, he did. Wednesday. Chapter 13. Pretty Sentimental. The next morning, things were still unbearably awkward between Eva and Audrey. Eva's stomach was twisted in knots. It was less about the fight, really, and more about the way they'd spoken to each other. They never said purposefully hurtful things to each other. Other moms and daughters did, but not them. In silence, Audrey slipped out of the house with no breakfast. Eva was destroyed. She really was. But she knew she had to get this done. The second Audrey left, she threw on a short but casual tank dress, tousled her curls to hair vlogger lusciousness, and speed-walked to the F train. In the 3 blocks to the subway, her tiny migraine escalated from dull to abusive, June humidity, and threatened to puncture her fearlessness. She ducked into a bodega bathroom and shot herself in the thigh with her injectable painkiller. By the time she showed up in the West Village, she had a numb thigh, a woozy brain, and limp hair. But she remained focused. After grabbing 2 iced coffees at a beat-up 8th Avenue cafe, she rushed through the labyrinthine cobblestone streets till she found the address. Horatio Street oozed with designer charm and old New York splendor. Shaded by lush, overgrown trees, number 81 was the second to last on the block, a 19th-century red-brick townhouse. It loomed one story taller than the rest, with a majestic stoop leading up to a dramatic, cerulean blue front door. Eva climbed the majestic stoop of the townhouse, pausing at the top stair, breathing hard, her hands frozen, the iced coffees dripping onto her Adidas. With no free hand to knock on the door, she gently kicked it with her foot. Nothing happened. She kicked it again, still nothing. And then it opened. Shane stood in the doorway, frustratingly broad-shouldered, bright-eyed, and exquisite. All rumpled white tee and gray joggers, pornographic. His expression reading pure, unabashed shock. "You're here," breathed Eva. "You're here," he said on an exhale. "You came." Eva nodded. "I did." He thumbed his bottom lip, trying not to smile. "Why?" "To bring you coffee," she said, because she didn't know how to tell him the truth. She thrust the cup into his hand. "Thanks," he said, confused. So I went too hard with the texting, I'm sorry. It was the way you left, I was worried."
"No need. I'm fine."
She caught her exceedingly nervous, fidgety reflection in the window. She didn't look fine. She looked like she was on her 5th grande latte.
"Wanna come in?" "I shouldn't."
"Oh." Shane hesitated a beat before adding, "Want me to come out?" Eva swayed a little, suddenly knocked off kilter. Here she was, standing before him in front of this big, beautiful old house, and she hadn't fully worked out her opener.
"You owe me," she blurted out.
"I owe you," he repeated. "Yeah." Shifting a tad, he thrust a hand in his pocket.
"For the coffee?"
This was so hard.
"No, I mean, look, I'm not here to talk about the past, but after the way we ended back then, you know you owe me."
"Oh,"
he exhaled, getting it. Hell yes, I owe you.
I need a favor.
Anything.
Really?
Nodding slowly, he caught her gaze.
What do you need?
Focus.
Will you teach English at my daughter's—
Yes, he interrupted.
School? I don't know how long you're staying, but the head of school is desperate for an English lit teacher for next school year. It's sort of an emergency.
Yes.
Don't you want to know why?
With twinkly eyes, he said, tell me later.
Bold of you to assume there'll be a later.
Bold of you to assume there won't be.
Eva's eyebrows shot up to her hairline. Excuse me?
A platonic later. Shane gestured at her with his coffee. You're saying the past is truly behind us, right?
Right.
So, let's start over. Be friends. You got somewhere to be?
Frowning, she glanced at her watch. Yeah, my life is, well, it's falling apart.
Want to talk about it? She shook her head.
No. I better go.
Okay. Shane's expression gave away nothing. Bye.
Surprised, Eva let out an involuntary huff.
Bye?
Leaning into the doorframe, Shane said, You want me to convince you to play hooky? If you want to do it, do it. You're grown.
Fine. She cocked her head, sizing him up. Are you still dangerous?
He chuckled. Are you?
I'm a mom. I write letters to principals demanding energy-efficient classrooms.
And I was researching a silent Zen retreat 5 minutes before you showed up. We're so boring now. What trouble could we get into? Biting his bottom lip, he raised his coffee cup toward her.
1 hour, she said, clicking her cup against his. Tops.
She took in his satisfied, sure smile. She'd never been sturdy enough to withstand that.
First things first. Eva had to tell Bridget O'Brien the good news. As she quickly emailed Bridget, her fingers flying excitedly over her phone, a sense of exhilarated relief flooded her. Audrey's place at Cheshire Prep, and everything they'd worked for, was safe. Her baby's academic career saved. Thank God for Shane. And then as quickly as it came, her relief began to dissolve into something else. The slowly dawning realization that Shane was staying. Shane, in her city, infiltrating her world. It was a small price to pay for Audrey's academic career. She wouldn't stress about this now. Instead, all she felt was gratefulness. The sun shone amber and hot, but there was a gorgeous breeze, a perfect day for aimless wandering. So when Shane suggested they walk along the High Line, she cautiously agreed. It'd be a chill outing for a couple of old friends. Whatever they were, Shane and Eva hit the hidden stairwell up to the High Line, just behind the tourist-packed Whitney Museum. The elevated promenade connecting the West Village to Chelsea was filled with food carts, fountains, and shaded gardens overlooking the city. After a short walk, they found the mini amphitheater fronted by a glass wall looking over 10th Avenue. Eva was a bundle of nerves, but she felt surprisingly calm in Shane's presence. The sparse crowd on the steps radiated an infectious lazy day calm. A nursing mom, a dog walker sunbathing with 4 Yorkies, an older couple sipping lemonade. Eva and Shane picked a spot and carefully launched into hesitant small talk about the weather, book sales, the second season of Atlanta. Soon, after slipping into an easy silence, Eva dropped the circular chit-chat and dove in.
So, she started, 81 Horatio Street.
My address? What about it? He shook his coffee, melting the ice.
That was James Baldwin's house.
As stated, he noted, by the plaque on the door.
No, I'm a Baldwin obsessive. I know he lived there from 1958 to 1961.
She raised her brows pointedly. He wrote Another Country in that house.
He did, didn't he?
Crossing her arms, Eva hit him with a squinty-eyed look.
That's the novel you were reading on the bleachers when we met. He folded his arms and met her eyes. Poetic coincidence.
Shane.
He beamed. You're pretty sentimental, bruh, she said. And you remembered it. So you are too. With his smile splitting his face, Shane leaned back on his forearms, crossing his legs in front of him. The sun bounced off the planes of his skin. She found him stupidly irresistible.
If you have the opportunity to make a moment meaningful, why not take it? He continued.
I could have stayed at a Ramada Inn with sad salesmen dying slowly of cliché and ennui. Or I could rent my favorite author's house and hopefully get inspired to write. If not, I'd at least enjoy a week of full circle symbolism.
How's that working for you?
The full circle symbolism? Well, we're sitting on bleachers again 15 Junes later, so I'd say it's going pretty well.
They shared a quiet look.
Eva turned away first.
I meant the writing, she emphasized.
I can't make words do what I want them to do anymore.
He sounded resigned.
Eva set her coffee down.
It's like those cases where people suffer major head trauma, slip into a coma, and wake up speaking a different language.
I'd imagine that's what it's like, writing sober for the first time.
Yeah, said Shane,
mulling this over. Then he let out a small, mirthless chuckle. It's exactly like that. Like I woke up one day and didn't know English. I'm trying to write in a language I no longer speak. Then he said, I can't write sober. I haven't said that out loud till now.
Eva leaned back and they were almost shoulder to shoulder.
Not that I ever watched any footage of you over the years, she smiled at him. But you never seemed messy drunk, just sleepy.
God, is this about the NAACP awards?
I'm just saying you hit it well.
Acting sober is an art, he explained. The trick is to say very little and be very still. And if you do that too well, sleep inevitably happens.
I read somewhere, started Eva, that on movie sets actors spin around in circles before shooting drunk scenes, so they're dizzy and off balance.
Smart, he said, swirling the ice in his coffee again, a twinkly, soothing sound. You know what extras in crowd scenes do to look like they're mid-conversation? They repeat peas and carrots over and over, but gesticulate like they're really saying shit.
Is that true? She nudged him with her shoulder.
Act mad.
Scrunching up his handsome features into a menacing scowl, he mouthed, peas and carrots, peas and carrots. He looked like a furious golden retriever. Eva burst out laughing.
What's funny?
Shane Hall, you're not scary anymore.
I know I put the hug in thug.
They both giggled, until they'd forgotten what was funny. Eventually, they lapsed into comfortable silence, enjoying the sun. When Shane's phone dinged, he lazily glanced down and saw it was from Ty. A selfie of his round, smiling face next to a cute girl with braids, both holding ice cream cones.
Today is perfect, he thought, damn near giddily. Everything's perfect.
I can't get over how much lighter you are now, said Eva, taking in his expression.
Can I ask you how you stopped? Was it AA?
Shane thought about this, folding his straw wrapper into a tiny square.
Nah, I hated AA. The endless sharing and group therapy. All to figure out why you drink. I've always known why, and it never stopped me. I got sober 'cause I wanted to. It was stop or die.
He turned to look at her. I'm too narcissistic to die.
Huh? You sure therapy didn't work?
Shane was on the verge of a retort, and then he got distracted by the sun glinting off her bare arms. His eyes traveled across her skin, no longer scarred, but scattered with delicate black tattoos. A half moon, the Louisiana state symbol, a feather. Someone's birth date etched into a dreamy, flower-strewn vine encircling her wrist. Her art was a beautiful distraction. You'd never know what was underneath.
How do you stop, Genevieve?
Eva,
she said softly. I know, he said after a pause. It's hard for me to say.
It's okay, she said.
And it was. After us, I went to a mandatory psychiatric center for self-harm.
Your mom sent you?
No, the police, she said, offering no more information. At the center, I found out that cutting was a reaction to feeling helpless. The only time I felt control. She ran her hand up and down her left arm, as if protecting it from searing memories. Before that, I thought of it as a divine ritual. Mayans believed that at birth, the gods gift humans with blood so you cut yourself to give it back, like a spiritual cleansing.
You ever miss it? Asked Shane.
Sometimes, she admitted in a slight voice. Usually in the shower. I miss the sting when the water hit my cuts. Pretty sick, huh?
Not to me, he said, with no judgment at all.
Eva sank into his energy, relaxing a bit, thankful for it.
I don't miss drinking, he continued. But I do miss having a crutch. At first, I'd look at sober people like, damn, y'all really out here feeling everything?
Yeah, I miss having a way to mute it all.
I miss vices.
In silence, they sat shoulder to shoulder, inches apart, bodies mirroring each other, but not touching.
You're still wearing the ring, he said.
She didn't realize he'd been looking at her. Heart fluttering, Eva held up her hand, squinting at her old cameo ring in the sun.
It makes me feel protected, I don't know why.
Do you have anything like that, like a security blanket?
No.
Shane looked out into the street. No, not anymore. Eva tucked a curl behind her ear, watching hipsters leave Artichoke Basili's Pizza down on 10th Avenue. And then offering Shane a shy smile, she stood up, heading down the bleachers to the glass wall. Standing there, she leaned forward until her forehead rested against the cool glass. The feeling was incredible, like she was suspended in the air over the street below, like the world stopped and started here. Her eyes fluttered shut, and she felt Shane stand next to her.
I did this with Audrey once, she told him. Feels like you're floating, right? Close your eyes.
They stood there for a beat, or two or three, before she glanced at Shane. Shane's eyes weren't closed at all. He was drinking her in, his expression wide open and mesmerized. In the sun, his eyes shone paler than usual. Eva remembered this color, this gold-flecked honey. She remembered it all. How easy it was falling into him. One minute she was fine, the next minute she was gone.
Let's go, said Shane, breaking whatever spell they'd fallen under.
Eva blinked.
Where?
To find new vices, undangerous ones.
Are they worth it?
Asked Eva.
If they aren't dangerous?
Don't know.
And then with boyish delight, he said, let's find out.
Shane and Eva found their first safe vice, an artisanal gelato stand on Little West 12. And they went hard, ordering 3 scoop cones before heading back out to the shadow-dappled, maze-like West Village streets. Shane's cone was brimming over with olive oil ice cream, and Eva's was cinnamon cappuccino gelato. It was delicious. The whole afternoon was delicious. So much so that Shane was already nostalgic for it before it had even ended. It was like the space-time continuum had hiccuped, and they'd never not known each other. They were light as air, giddy with their rekindled friendship. Shane wouldn't dare tempt fate by asking for more than this. This moment was perfect enough. Just this. Just Eva. An Aphrodite in Adidas. His distractingly, dizzyingly sexy Eva, who had barely touched her gelato because she'd spent the last 7 blocks deconstructing the feminist subtext in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Shane,
Not even a superhero guy was instantly converted. Eva's passion was contagious. Her laugh felt weightless. Her delivery was so bossy. At one point, deep in discourse, she used her glasses as a headband, pulling back her hair, and Shane watched one spiral escape, bouncing onto her forehead in agonizing slow-mo. I'd risk it all for that single curl. Shane was aware that he was going nuts. It was almost too much to walk, talk, and eat ice cream at the same time. Thankfully, Eva plopped down on a bench outside of a 19th-century apothecary. As she finally dug into her melting gelato, he asked the question that had been on his mind since that morning. "Subject change," he said clunkily. "Why'd you say your life's falling apart?" After a dramatic groan, Eva explained Audrey's Snapchat scandal. "And Audrey's a dream, but she thinks she knows everything about the world. She's desperate to be grown. It's scary. Mothering her, I feel so lost sometimes. My only example is my mom, who was many things, but mother wasn't quite one of them." Before Shane could answer, he saw that across the street on the corner, an olive-skinned 20-something with a pink ponytail was gawking at them. She grinned, typed something into her phone, and then giggled. Thankfully, she wasn't in Eva's line of vision. "Motherfuck," he thought, ducking his head. The young fangirls were so wild. The kind with 8 inked on 8 different body parts. "You never really told me about your mom," he said, facing away from the girl. Eva licked her gelato. "Let's see. She was from a tiny town, Bellefleur. Growing up, people called her Mandy, a nickname for Mantis, because she was born with her hands in a prayer like a praying mantis. On the bayou," she started in her mom's Louisiana drawl, "your given name is just a suggestion," she smiled. "Lizette suits her better. Sounds fragile and tragic." "That's my mom," said Eva, nodding. "Anyway, she wasn't trained for anything beyond winning pageants. She got all the way to Miss Universe in 1987, but was disqualified." "On some Vanessa Williams shit?" asked Shane. "No, because she couldn't enter the swimsuit competition with a second trimester bump," she chuckled. "After I was born, we moved to L.A., but she was too short to model, and her accent was too thick to act. Her saviors were rich men. She became a sort of professional mistress, which was lucrative for a while. The homes, clothes, schools, all top-notch. You know, I don't remember the inside of any apartments I lived in as a kid. Just the view from my bedroom windows. A man-made lake with marble mermaid fountain in Vegas. The back of a ritzy Persian restaurant in Chicago. In Atlanta, it was a cul-de-sac with a heavy stray cat population, all of which I named after Wu-Tang members." "That's a lot of cats." "After each breakup, we'd move. By the time I was a teenager, the cities had gotten seedier and the men she chose were nightmares. But she never saw trouble coming, you know, she was so childlike," said Eva. "She slept all day, went out at night, and I was left on my own." Eva paused, her brow low. "Lizette was a kook. But to be fair, her mom, my grandma Clotilda, also a confirmed kook." "She was a professional mistress too?" "No, a murderess."
"A what?"
"Grandma Clotilda had fits, fainting spells, the blues, and—" She stopped abruptly.
"And what?"
"Violent headaches." Shane stared at her unblinking. "The town thought she was possessed, especially since she'd get excruciating headaches after she drank the blood of Christ every Sunday at Mass. Of course, the blood of Christ was just cheap red wine, a classic migraine trigger, but no one knew this in the 50s. Eva laughed a little. "Everyone thought she was a—"
"A witch," interrupted Shane, looking incredulous. "A witch with migraines."
Eva's dimple popped. "One day my grandfather was singing in the shed in this loud baritone. Legend has it she was having a month-long spell and couldn't bear the noise, so she went crazy and shot him. The sheriff was too scared of her to prosecute, but she was run out of town.
She left Lizette with an aunt and started over in Shreveport. Oh, and she became an entrepreneur. Apparently, she made a mean jambalaya. She cashed in on the witch thing, selling her recipe at county fairs. Cloves, witch's brew, spices kissed by Satan himself. Her handcrafted labels show up on Southern aesthetic Pinterest boards. My mom told me all of this. She was one hell of a storyteller. It's the only thing we have in common. Shane slumped back against the bench. This is your lineage? That's some remarkably dark, fantastic shit. It gets darker. Eva had been holding on to these stories her entire life and was ecstatic to let them go. When Chloe was an infant, her mom, Delphine, took off in the dead of night. No warning. Just fled to New Orleans and passed as a Sicilian. Changed Mercier to Michelli, became a showgirl, married the attorney general, had a white son, conquered 1930s society, and when her husband died a few years later, she inherited his house. A secretly black woman owned the finest mansion in the very, very racist Garden District. Imagine living with the fear of being found out, said Shane. I guess she couldn't. At 40, she drowned herself in the tub during her annual Christmas party with a house full of New Orleans aristocrats. She wrote Passant Blanc on the tiles in lipstick. Outed herself. Eva shrugged vaguely. The story was buried, apparently. I have white cousins who don't know who they are. I found them on Facebook. They're extremely white, too. Republican white. You have Fotalian family members. Shane wanted more. As Eva talked, she transformed, her hands floating in the air as if grabbing pieces of the story, her voice fluid, shape-shifting like she'd lived the stories herself. Eva was all of these women. This is a book, said Shane. Please write it. Right? And what would the title be, Unstable Mothers and Unattended Daughters? Eva sounded like she'd thought about this. A lot. Plus, I have to write book 15 before I start anything else. This is the book you brought up at the diner, said Shane, remembering. The one you said no one would read? You're wrong. This is Black American history told through some fascinating matriarchal badasses. Look, Audrey doesn't know about any of this. She thinks Lizette's a hero. I've tweaked history a bit, because I want her to be proud of who she is. Insisted Eva. I've never even been to Bellefleur. Go! Abuzz with energy, Shane turned his whole body to face her. Go! Can't. Eva shook her head. It'd require breaking myself open. Why don't you want to? It's a mess in there, she said hollowly. He wondered when the last time she'd fallen apart in front of someone was. But that's the good stuff. He insisted. It's you. I can't afford to fall apart, she said. Eva met his eyes then, and Shane saw that she looked starved. Something potent and protective hit him. He wanted to grab her and run, which, historically speaking, probably wouldn't end well. Shane, she said quietly. Why haven't you said my name? Shane flinched, caught off guard. It was disorienting, being caught between what he felt then versus his feelings now. If Shane spoke her new name, then she stopped being a memory. She became tangible, and he'd have to confront what was real, which was that Eva Mercy was unspooling him as slowly and surely as if she'd tugged a thread. Shane was here to come clean and go. Falling for her wasn't the plan. I can't say your new name. Why? Hesitantly, he said, I can't afford to fall apart either. Shane heard Eva's tiny huff of breath and saw her lips part, but he never got to hear her answer. Because there was the pink ponytailed chick standing in front of them, blocking the sun, waving maniacally as if she were a great distance away. Jolted out of a big moment, they peered up at her with confused, Eva, and annoyed, Shane, expressions. Hi,
she shouted. I'm Charlie, with two eyes.
We all have two eyes, Shane muttered.
I saw that you guys had, like, an intense vibe. I thought you might need to relax, so I'm inviting you in. But hurry, we close at 3 p.m.
In where? Asked Eva.
The Dream House. I'm the door girl.
Pink Ponytail gestured at a nondescript townhouse across the street. It had a black door with a sign reading, The Dream House, in white block letters. A midtown corporate woman in Ann Taylor separate stumbled out, yawning contentedly.
Oh, breathed Eva, facing Shane. I read about this on Refinery 29. It's an art installation that's like preschool nap time, but for adults. You drop by, meditate, sleep, chill, and then go back to work, refreshed.
Shane was skeptical. 20 years ago, he would have robbed every sleeping idiot in that house.
Is napping around strangers safe? Asked Eva, damn near reading his mind.
We have thorough rules, insisted Pink Ponytail. So Dream House is a sound and light immersive experience. The rooms are dark except for soft lilac lights, and there's incense and hypnotic music, but you'll hear different tones whether you're standing, sitting, or lying down,
she pitched.
Out here, it's chaos, global warming, Mike Pence. In there, it's peace, art, freedom. It's like a safe acid trip.
A drugless high? Eva looked at Shane. Shane looked at Eva.
10 minutes later, Shane and Eva were enveloped in a womb-like room, floating away. By then, Charlie with two eyes Sanchez had already uploaded her iPhone 10 pic of Shane and Eva onto the cursed Facebook group with a detailed description of the sighting. As backup events coordinator of the quite niche Latinx Bruja Association at Queens College, she was a massive fan of Eva's girl power witch. But as a lifelong New Yorker, she was far too cool to let Eva know.